The Irish Independent and Irish Daily Mail both lead this morning with concerns surrounding the cybersecurity threat to government departments after it emerged yesterday that the Department of Health had also been the target of a ransomware attack following the attack on the HSE on Friday. The Independent reports that the FBI and the UK's National Crime Agency will assist the investigation into the attack, which has caused widespread disruption to health services. While the Mail takes the line that all state departments have been put on high alert, with fears that access to pensions and state benefits could be hindered if the Department of Social Protection is targeted. For its lead story, the Irish Times quotes Minister of State for Communications, Oisin Smith, saying that the hackers behind the HSE attack may publish patient data online. He stressed, however, that much of the information stored centrally by the HSE relates to administrative rather than clinical details. We're told that similar attacks, such as one on the Scottish Environmental Protection Agency last year, saw information published online after ransoms went unpaid, although Mr. Smith said that data is often posted by hackers, whether ransoms are paid or not. The Irish Sun leads with the line that the Russian criminal gang Wizard Spider, which is thought to be responsible for the first attack on the HSE, is also believed to be behind the attack on the Department of Health. And in common with a number of other papers today, the lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror quotes Simon Coveney's comments on RTÉ's This Week programme yesterday, in which he said that the HSE has set up a war room in Molesworth Street to prevent further cyber attacks. The prospect of vaccinated people being able to fly abroad by late summer will take a giant leap forward tomorrow as cabinet ministers are to approve a major easing of restrictions on travel. That's according to the lead story in the Irish Examiner, which reports that it's expected that the government will approve a plan to remove most, if not all, European countries from the mandatory hotel quarantine list as part of a move to adopt the EU Digital Green Cert. The Northern papers both lead today with stories about the newly elected leader of the DUP. The Irish News reports that Edwin Poots is expected to delay the appointment of his Stormont ministerial team to allow time to consult his divided party, and that he also plans to instigate a clear out of senior party aides, while the Belfast Telegraph leads with his intention to meet with loyalist terror groups in a bid to persuade them to give up violence and criminality. And finally, under the headline A Chance for the Centre Ground, the Times devotes its lead editorial today to the election of Edwin Poots. The writer suggests that in the long run, the elevation of Poots could well increase the potential for the growth of a strong middle ground alternative to the DUP and Sinn Féin. An increasing number of younger voters are open to a new brand of politics. It would be ironic, the piece concludes, if the election of a hardline DUP leader helped to undermine the appeal of tribal politics.
The HSE will today continue the task of restoring its computer systems, which remain severely affected by a ransomware attack. In the meantime, however, significant numbers of patients can expect to have appointments, scans and procedures cancelled. For instance, at Dublin's Rotunda Hospital, all routine appointments for women who are less than 36 weeks into their pregnancy have been postponed. Stacey Kelly is one expectant mother who's been affected by the cancellations. She spoke to our reporter, Amy Nirieda.
I'm 22 weeks pregnant and I'm attending a Rotunda. My first scan was at 15 weeks and my big scan is due to be next Friday, which has been cancelled due to the cyber attack. I was a bit nerve-wracking. I only actually found out online this evening. So I'm looking to probably go private now and pay like €175 to make sure everything's all right. And I have another child as well, so just for peace of mind for her as well, that she's very excited obviously for baby number two, so we have to kind of keep her in the loop as well about it and tell her that there was a cyber attack. I don't think she'll understand. It's a little bit nerve-wracking as well that there's no dates for anybody that has had a cancelled appointment. It's just you'll be rescheduled as soon as possible.
And that was Stacey Kelly speaking to us last night. We can talk now to Professor Fergal Malone, who's the master of the Rotunda Hospital. Good morning.
Good morning, Rachel.
You've decided to cancel routine appointments for the next 7 days, so Stacey isn't alone in being affected. Why is that?
The Rotunda is one of only two hospitals in Ireland that is totally electronic. So we have no paper records. We don't have charts. So for patients who are coming in for non-emergency, non-urgent issues, we won't have any background information on what the patient's issues are. And then when we do a scan, for example, we won't be able to store the images or save them the way we normally would do. So we have contingency plans in place for this, Rachel, and we plan to be able to bring these services, elective services, scheduled services, back online next week, hopefully. But certainly for this week, it would make sense to not do any scheduled elective work when we have no way of retrieving old information or saving new information.
So apart from routine appointments for women who are less than 36 weeks pregnant, what else have you had to cancel?
And similarly, we've had to cancel all of our elective gynecology work. So gynecologic outpatients and patients coming in for a scheduled gynecologic surgery. And again, for the logical reason, Rachel, that if a patient comes in expecting to be operated on for an elective operation, our surgeons won't have background information or background notes or background scans to look at before doing an operation. And obviously that would be inappropriate.
How many women is this likely to affect?
Well, unfortunately, it's going to affect hundreds of women. As the busiest maternity hospital in the country, we would have hundreds of patients every day coming into the Rotunda for routine appointments. But in addition, we have large numbers of patients who come in every day in late pregnancy, obviously, to deliver babies, or with patients who have active ongoing pregnancy challenges or complications. Those are unaffected, and obviously it is very important for any pregnant woman with any concerns whatsoever to still come in, and all of our normal services are working. We've switched the hospital entirely to paper-based over the weekend, so we are fully functioning and can provide all services to patients from today.
What about women who are waiting for test results, who say had a scan or procedure last week? Are they affected?
Well, in maternity services, scans and results from scans are available immediately. So there wouldn't be any patients from last week who had scans done who would be waiting for those.
But say, I'm thinking maybe of a biopsy or something. Are they likely to be affected by this?
No. Any abnormal laboratory result is being phoned directly through from our pathologist and laboratory staff to the lead consultant and is being communicated on to a patient. So there'll be no question of any abnormal results, delayed, missed, or not communicated to a patient. So we have contingency plans in place to secure that, Rachel.
What about women with crisis pregnancies? Will they still be seen?
Absolutely. So, as you know, there's legislation in Ireland that for pregnancy termination, most patients who would choose pregnancy termination have a 12-week limit. So obviously that's time sensitive. So we would every week have a small number of patients coming through for pregnancy termination services under 12 weeks, and obviously they could not be put off. So we have a system in place to manage those patients and provide care for that small number of patients in that situation.
We heard Stacey there a few minutes ago saying that she would probably now go private and try and have a scan that way. Is that something that you expect many women to do?
No, and I would discourage that. There's no need for patients to elect to have additional private services. We are very confident that all patients who have appointments that are deferred this week will get their care services in the very, very near future. There's no reason to put something off or go down for a private scan somewhere else. We will be able to provide patients those services. The scans we're talking about are scans that there's no medical reason where it must be done today, where it couldn't, for example, be done next Monday. So I do think we will have the capacity to look after all patients.
Professor Fergal Malone, thanks indeed for joining us this morning.
Police in the north say they're increasingly concerned for the welfare of two boys last seen in Belfast on Friday. They say 5-year-old Patrick Hobart and his older brother Fabrizio, who is 8, may be in the company of a relative and may have been taken to Dublin. Our reporter Laura Hogan joins us now. What's happened, Laura?
Yes, good morning, Gavin. Well, brothers 8-year-old Fabrizio and 5-year-old Patrick Hovarth from North Belfast were last seen in the Limestone Road area of the city on Friday. At around 6 o'clock that evening, they were seen getting into the back of a black Ford Focus car. Police in Northern Ireland believe that the boys are with a relative and that they could be in Northern Ireland or they could have travelled south to Dublin. Now, they say they are increasingly concerned about the boys' welfare and have asked for the public's help to locate them. Inspector Phil McCullough with the PSNI said they are keen to know that both boys are safe and well, and they appealed for the person who the boys are with to get in touch.
What are Gardaí asking people to do, Laura?
Yes, well, Gardaí last night also issued an appeal for information on behalf of the PSNI. Both boys, we are told, Fabricio and his little brother Patrick, are described as having dark hair. And at the time they were last seen, five-year-old Patrick was wearing light-coloured bottoms and top with black shoes, while eight-year-old Fabricio was wearing grey bottoms and a purple and green top. So the PSNI have appealed directly, as I say, to the person who they believe the boys might be with to contact them, as well as members of the public. And they've given out a number to call. So people calling from the Republic of Ireland or who are roaming on an Irish network or even from anywhere else outside the UK can contact the PSNI on this number. It's 0044-2890-650-222. And pictures of both the boys and that number can be found on the RTÉ News website.
Laura Hogan in Belfast, thank you.
Proposals to clamp down on investment funds block buying new housing developments will go to Cabinet tomorrow. This follows more than 2 weeks of political pressure after news broke that an entire estate in Maynooth had been brought up by such a fund. Yesterday's Business Post reported that more than €225 million of government funding earmarked for boosting housing supply was ultimately used by funds to buy up houses and apartments. Well, there's been plenty of criticism of the government's plan to tackle the issue of housing. So how would opposition parties tackle the crisis if they were in charge? Tommy Meskell of our political staff has been finding out.
There's corporations coming in, hoovering up houses off people that are, can't afford to live in the city, work in the city, trade in the city, can't do anything.
Just no coherent strategy from any of the parties, I believe, and how they're going to fix it. And I think the opposition, when they speak, they're oversimplifying it just for sound bites instead of actually coming together with proper solutions.
If an opposition government came in, I wouldn't know that they would exactly change things straight away. I think it would be longer term we need to do.
Ireland's housing crisis has shaped the lives of many over the years, and there's been no end to the political punches.
Not alone do you not have a plan of your own, Taoiseach, you also will reject the plans of others.
And your policies are shallow. There's an absence of substance behind them. You're more about rhetoric and sloganeering.
So how would opposition parties tackle the crisis if they found themselves in government?
My name is Owen O'Brien and I'm Sinn Féin spokesperson on housing. We would double direct capital investment in the delivery of social and affordable homes by local authorities, approved housing bodies and community housing trusts. That would allow us to deliver on average 20,000 social and genuinely affordable homes every year for 5 years of government.
Under the government's plan, 9,500 new social homes will be completed this year. Overall, roughly 15,000 to 20,000 new homes will be delivered in 2021, fewer than hoped for due to COVID. Ireland needs about 33,000 new homes a year. Rent pressure zones are in place, intended to prevent rents in certain areas increasing by more than 4% per year. But Sinn Féin want a complete ban on increases.
We would ban rent increases for 3 years. We would give renters real security of tenure, while of course building large volumes of genuine affordable rental accommodation.
Who's building those? Is it the private builder?
So look, all homes are built by private building contractors. That's the case today, and that would be the case under Sinn Féin's proposals. But what we want is the role of local authorities as the developer of public housing. And when I say public housing, I'm not just talking about social housing.
This government has pledged €3 billion on housing this year. What would your housing budget be?
If I was the Minister for Housing today, we would be spending everything the government is spending and an additional €1.4 billion. But the big difference is not just the amount, it's what you do with the money. And what we want is more money directly spent on the building of homes.
The government will spend €3.1 billion on housing this year. Approximately €2 billion is on capital expenditure and around €1 billion on current expenditure, which includes the likes of the housing assistance payment to help people afford their rents.
Senator Rebecca Moynihan, the Labour Party spokesperson on housing.
The Labour Party say Ireland needs more secure tenancies.
I think if we still have so many people in the private rented sector as they are getting older, I think it's a ticking time bomb. So things like long leases, affordable rental. You can achieve affordable rental by people who are on higher incomes cross-subsidising, it being tied to about 30% of people's incomes, and also that the loan term is over a longer time, and you link that in and you create a more secure and stable rental sector.
This month, government published their affordable housing bill. It includes several measures to tackle the crisis, including a requirement for 10% social homes and 10% affordable homes in new developments, a cost rental scheme and a new shared equity scheme, and plans to deliver 6,000 affordable homes on state lands within 4 years. Opposition have criticised many aspects of the bill. Richard Boyd Barris of People Before Profit outlines how he would tackle the crisis.
The state has to intervene very heavily and directly provide public and affordable housing at a price that ordinary workers can afford. I don't think the market is capable of doing that at the moment.
Would you be using private builders, though?
Oh, I think undoubtedly, although actually we think we need a state construction company. We need to marshal the building capacity that currently exists in order to build directly.
All opposition parties have their own ideas on how to tackle investment funds. Governments will soon unveil their own plans. Keane O'Callaghan of the Social Democrats believes the market is too reliant on them.
They're getting this kind of dominant role where they're able to outbid everyone else, so that needs to end. And we have an issue where they're, you know, in effect being guaranteed by the state, who are signing up long-term leases with them. There's, you know, some instances where the state is actually funding the construction of homes, which are then being sold onto an investment fund, which are then being, you know, rented out for the next 50 years. So we should be using state resources in a much more focused way to deliver affordable homes and social homes.
And that was Keane O'Callaghan of the Social Democrats, ending that report from Tommy Meskell.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with the Kia Dealers of Ireland. Our doors are open again for sales and test drives. Find your local Kia dealer at kia.com.
Now, with news of heartwarming comebacks from Liverpool and Meath and all the rest of today's sports news, here's Darren Fretter. Morning, Darren.
Yeah, to get Meath in, Gavin. They did well. But let's start with that amazing and dramatic comeback for Liverpool. The club struggling to finish in the top four for much of the season. And yesterday, they found themselves drawing with relegated West Brom. 4 minutes of injury time was up. Liverpool have a corner, and then their goalkeeper, Alisson, joins the attack for one final push. This was literally the last kick of the game. It's been an eventful season for him. He lost his dad tragically back in February, and only days before the game, his wife gave birth to their third child. He certainly made his mark yesterday.
It will feel like a defeat, even though that it's not, but the consequences of it will mean that Liverpool have lost ground in the race for the Champions League. This will be it then. Alisson is up from the back. And it comes. Alisson! Oh, would you believe it? The Liverpool goalkeeper in injury time has won it for Liverpool.
I'm too emotional these last months for everything that happened with me, with my family. But football is my life. I play since I remember. As a human being, with my father, I hope he was here to see it, but I'm sure that he's seeing with the God on his side and celebrating. I can't be more happy than I am now.
Drama and emotion, RTÉ analyst Paul Corrie joins me. Paul, have you ever seen anything like that?
I guess the Manchester United Champions League final in the Nou Camp somewhat resembles the late drama, but I've never seen a goalkeeper come up and take a header like such an experienced centre forward, Darren. It was full of drama, but it was superb technique. It was a great ball in from Trent and an unbelievable finish from Alisson, and a man they rely on so much at the other end. For him to pop up with a goal like that, I think is going to be enough to get them over the line for the top four, but a really, really dramatic game of football.
Sure. Do you think when a day like that comes along, if it's your day?
Yeah, I do. I thought Liverpool played their get out of jail free card yesterday, Darren. The first goal in particular, Mike Dean has stopped the game and awarded Liverpool a free kick when it probably should have been a hot ball. And from there, they've gone on and scored their first. West Brom had a goal ruled out from a set piece that on another day, VAR would have allowed. And they huffed and puffed and they failed to create chances, and the top three didn't really have any cutting edge to them against a West Brom team who were already down. And when your keeper comes up and he produces a header like that and pulls a result out of the bag, you somewhat have a feeling that it's just meant to be for Liverpool. And with the two fixtures they have left, I understand that at this time of the season wins are hard to come by, but with Burnley away and Palace at home, you would imagine there's enough in that Liverpool team to pick up 6 points there.
There's a huge game tomorrow night. It's Leicester and Chelsea, who are above them in the table. Is their destiny in their own hands?
Yeah, so I mean, much of the top four is going to hinge on this result between Chelsea and Leicester tomorrow. A win for Leicester will guarantee them top four. Two wins from Chelsea from their last two games against Leicester and then against Aston Villa away would also guarantee them top four. So much will depend, and the permutations will depend on the result tomorrow. For me, I just think with Leicester, their league form has been hit and miss, particularly over the last couple of weeks. The highs and the emotions of winning their first FA Cup, it's going to be very difficult to regroup, refocus and get going again for another league game. But Chelsea's league form, the first time now they've put back-to-back performances under Thomas Tuchel, which haven't been great. Can they rejuvenate and get going again? I think so. I think the top teams, Liverpool and Chelsea, will be the ones who will end up in that top four.
Okay, Paul, great talking to you as always. Wins also for Tottenham, who beat Wolves, Crystal Palace and Sheffield United as well. Barcelona won the Women's Champions League last night, 4-0 winners against Chelsea. All four goals in the first half, first win for them in the competition. Limerick's long unbeaten run has come to an end. The All-Ireland and League Hurling Champions lost to Galway by 6 points in Salthill. First defeat for them since 2019. Wexford came from 8 points down to beat Clare by a point. Kilkenny got the better of Antrim. Waterford overcame Westmeath. In football, Dublin were too strong for Roscommon. Armagh back in Division 1 for the first time since 2012. They were 4 point winners against Monaghan. Wins also for the mighty Meath, Gavin. Clare, Offaly and Sligo. And lots of talk again over the weekend about the rule changes, and we're going to be discussing that a little bit later on. More great news for the Irish rowing team. Two more crews have qualified for the Olympic Games. The women's four have got a place at the Olympics, as have the lightweight double, and we'll be talking to one of those heroes a little bit later on in the program. Another great finish for Dan Martin, who was fifth on stage 9 of the Giro. Win went to Egan Bernal, who now leads overall. Dan is just 51 seconds off the pace there. Kyung-hun Lee won the Byron Nelson event on the PGA Tour. Seamus Power finished inside the top 10, but his challenge faded. He started so well, second for a long time, but then a double bogey and bogey on 13 and 14. It undone his run. He ended up 7 off the winner, 18 under par. And finally, the Irish women's hockey team beat Scotland 4-1 in the second of their matches in Belfast. I'll be back in an hour.
Palestinian officials in Gaza say that yesterday was the deadliest day since the current violence began. More than 40 people were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Israel, meanwhile, says that Palestinian militants have fired more than 3,000 rockets over the past week. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned that further violence could plunge the region into what he called an uncontainable crisis. However, the Security Council, of which Ireland is currently a member, has been unable to agree on a public statement. Ayed Abu Ramadan lives in Gaza City with his wife and daughter. He's president of a football club there and has travelled to Ireland on a number of occasions with children from the club. He's been telling us about what life is like at the moment.
Every hour we have tens of raids by sea, land and air. Our home is shaking. We can clearly hear glass shattering. We can hear screams of children and women and men. We can see smoke outside. You know, this is what's going on for the past 8 days, actually. There are also shortage of electricity. We get it only 4 to 3 hours a day. Shortage of water, other supplies, food. We are really unable to go outside of our homes. It's not that our homes are safe, but it's safer than the street.
Tell us about your own situation. You were saying there that you're not able to leave the house at the moment.
Yes, it's very dangerous to leave the house, you know, because you know, it looks bad as it is from where I am, from my house. So going out is really, you know, we could hear all night the bombing of buildings. We've seen on TV the killing of innocent people who are in their homes. More than 100 buildings were bombed. More than 5,000 housing units were bombed. I can't risk going out of my home, especially leaving my family behind. I'm trying to be with my family all the time. So whatever happens will happen to all of us.
Are you scared all the time?
Of course, we are scared. We are actually traumatized. All children as well as adults are severely traumatized from the Israeli excessive use of fire. It's really, it's beyond the description, you know, bombing, shelling all night. It's really scary.
How do you see this coming to an end?
Basically, we have to end the immediate suffering of the people by a truce or something like this to allow basic needs in, like fuel and food supplies. Also for families to get water in their homes or wherever they are.
Now, I gather that you've been to Ireland a number of times. Will you tell us about that? Because you must know people here.
Yes, I know lots of people in Ireland, and they have been really kind to us all the time. Many of them are calling or sending messages through social media. They are telling us about their solidarity and support activities in Ireland. That really relieves us a lot, because we see that people of Ireland are standing with us, unlike most other people who are not really caring about the situation. So I really, from here, I send them all of our love and friendship.
Ayed Abu Ramadan talking to us earlier from Gaza City. Bel True, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, joins us now from Jerusalem. Bel, thanks for being with us this morning. Can you give us a sense of the overall situation at the moment?
Well, the latest is that there was another very heavy night of bombardment over Gaza, with civilians I was speaking to in the very early hours this morning saying there were as many as 50 airstrikes in just a few minutes. The Israeli army's come out with a statement saying that they had used about 54 warplanes to target what they call the metro, which is this, they say, an underground network of tunnels that militants used during fighting. They said they targeted 15 kilometers of that. Unfortunately, though, this metro, as it's nicknamed, is located underneath populated areas like Gaza City and also the north. So talking to civilians on the ground, they're saying that they were under immense amounts of airstrikes last night, that they were also hitting roads which were leading to, for example, Ashifa Hospital, which is the largest hospital in Gaza. So unfortunately, we don't have an updated death toll, but unfortunately, I suspect we will see the numbers rise in terms of dead and also in terms of, you know, women and children as well.
In public, at least, Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't sound as though he wants this to end quickly.
No, and actually speaking to Israeli generals on sort of background briefings, the message that I have received is that they have a specific list of targets and goals, objectives that they want to get through, and they haven't done that yet, and they will keep going until it's done, and then there will be a ceasefire. There's a very strong sense from them that their tolerance of rocket fire from Gaza has gone down to zero, and that they want to take out Hamas's capabilities to manufacture, launch these rockets, but also to fight. So this is why they're targeting the network of tunnels. So for now, for them, a ceasefire is not particularly interested. They're not particularly interested in a ceasefire for the next few days until they've finished their targets. And I will say this: there has been an incredibly heavy bombardment on the Israeli side. The Israeli army said yesterday that 3,100 rockets have been fired at Israel. I asked the Israeli army yesterday how many rockets were fired during the entirety of the seven-week war in 2014, and they told me that around 3,900 had been fired. So we're almost reaching the amount of rockets fired during the entire seven-week war in just a week, to give you a sense of just how heavy it is on the Israeli side. But of course, in Gaza, these incredible levels of bombardment are just seeing whole buildings being taken down, whole families being wiped out, women, children, you know. And I was speaking to medics yesterday. A lot of these shellings and airstrikes are having indirect damage on clinics, hospitals, ability for ambulances to move around. We had two senior Palestinian doctors killed in their homes yesterday as well. So it's, you know, the impact on civilians is huge. At the same time, however, you know, we are looking at an immense rocket barrage from Gaza into Israel.
Beltrú, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent, thank you for joining us.
Now, as it gets warmer and brighter, and with people being encouraged to spend more time with each other outdoors, more and more people are taking to the water and buying up floatables and inflatables to bring with them. Lidl has included water safety advice from the RNLI along with its water sports products, and the Lifeboat Institution is asking more businesses and organisations to help too. Lisa Hollingham is with us. She's the RNLI's Water Safety Delivery Support Officer for the Ireland region. Hi Lisa. I read where the French sports shop Decathlon say they've sold more surfboards in Ballymun than anywhere else in the world. Are you surprised by just how much interest there is here in boards, kayaks, canoes and the like?
Good morning, Gavin. Yes, I did read that news all right. And I suppose in one sense, we're happy to have all these people out on the water. But obviously, with this increase of people on the water, we need them to be aware of the risks that are associated with being out there. And that's why we have been working with the likes of Decathlon and Lidl and using these opportunities to promote our local ambassador scheme, where people can sign up via the website, get access to our water safety materials and share them in their community to help keep people safe this summer.
Because you haven't had much chance to go to schools and clubs this year to do water safety talks because of the virus. So what's your main advice to people who are using floatables and inflatables?
So our key safety messages would be to have a means of calling for help on your person, a mobile phone in a waterproof pouch. Check the weather and tides before going out, and especially with any inflatable SUPs or kayaks, do not go out if there's an offshore wind because that will blow you out to sea. Always wear a buoyancy aid or life jacket. Go with a friend. Tell someone where you're going and when you expect to be back. In an emergency, dial 112 or 999 and ask for the Coast Guard. And a particularly strong message this year would be to leave inflatable toys at home. They're not suitable for the beach or inland waterways. And that's the airbeds, the lilos, the inflatable dinghies, and the blow-up donuts and unicorns.
Yes, many people will remember the story of Ellen Glynn and her cousin Sarah Feeney, rescued after 15 hours at sea with their paddleboards last summer off the coast of Galway. And they talked about how their flotation devices played a big part in saving their lives.
Yeah, particularly with paddle boards, you need to make sure that you are connected to your board with a leash. So should you fall off, that you don't get separated from the paddle board and you have that flotation device to help keep you safe.
Lisa, thanks for speaking to us. That's Lisa Hollingham. She's the RNLI's Water Safety Delivery Support Officer for the Ireland region.
We are joined this morning by Mr. Justice John Hedigan, who is chair of the Irish Banking Culture Board. The board is publishing the findings of two surveys of culture and trust levels in banks and the banking sector today. Mr. Justice Hedigan, I'd like to begin by asking you about trust in banks' cybersecurity. Banks are closing branches as customers bank online, so customers need to be able to trust the technology that supports online banking. Did cybersecurity come up as a concern of customers in the survey?
Good morning, Petula, and thank you for inviting me onto the programme. Not directly, no, but it did come up in the context of trust in banking, one of the headings of which is integrity, as ability, integrity, dependability and purpose. So it came up under the heading of integrity. And there it was clear that there's a very substantial number of customers who do actually believe that banks handle their data securely and well. So it's encouraging in that way. That's the only way in which it came up in the survey. But of course, the cybersecurity and data protection are key concerns for all businesses that hold personal data and are priority areas of focus across the banking sector and in Irish Banking Culture Board member banks. I'm sure banks need no encouraging to make absolutely sure about the security of their data and their customers.
The survey of bank staff shows progress is being made internally across all member banks. But are you concerned that the results of the public trust survey show those internal changes in culture have yet to resonate with the majority of bank customers?
Yes, it is disturbing. It's a question of progress that is not resonating with the public. But, you know, that's what we're here for. That's the challenge. And there's a sort of logical progression involved here. We have to get things working within the staff before trust levels will improve publicly. Now, the results on the staff side are pretty encouraging, I must say. I'll give you three figures just to be quite brief about this. 85% of the staff report that they consider that in their bank people do business in an ethical manner. That's 9 points higher than the global financial services benchmark, and that's very encouraging. And backing that up was a 10-point improvement in the staff's perception of alignment between their bank's stated values and how it does business since 2018, since we started. The second figure is 58%. That's nearly 3 in 5 bank staff who feel that their organization's commitment to building a speak-up culture, which we've really focused on in the last 2 years, has strengthened since 2018. And that there has been, thirdly, the third figure, a 10-point increase to 69% of those who had a concern and felt comfortable to raise it in the period. We've been concentrating very hard on trying to help the banks to create an atmosphere in which people can safely challenge what they think is wrong, what they think should be, where they want to be the voice that challenges the emerging consensus. Okay. And that does appear to be happening. And we're encouraged, but there's still a lot of challenges there. But yes, there's a job to be done to persuade the public. But it's no surprise. I mean, trust lost is very difficult to regain. And we can only just keep going at it. We've said all along it requires patience, courage, persistence and commitment. And we'll certainly give it that.
And very briefly, Mr. Justice Hedigan, Ulster Bank and quite possibly KBC Ireland will be leaving the Irish market, which means reduced competition. Did that have an impact on trust levels in the survey from a customer's perspective?
I don't know is the answer to that question. I think that the reality of the situation is, first of all, it was KBC's intentions were not announced during the time this survey was taken, but Ulster Bank's were. It's hard to say, really, to answer that. But, of course, everyone is concerned about the diminution in the competition in the Irish market. It's hard to know what the consequences of that may be. There is, as the Minister of Finance has said, consolidation going on in banking all over Europe. But we're a small market, and to be left with three retail banks is going to be challenging.
Great. Listen, we will have to leave it there. Mr. Justice John Hedigan, Chair of the Irish Banking Culture Board, thank you for your time this morning.
The government's response to the two cyber attacks, the election of Edwin Poots as DUP leader, and the prospect that vaccinated people would be able to holiday abroad by the end of the summer are some of the stories covered on your front pages this morning. The Irish Independent and Irish Daily Mail both lead with concerns surrounding the cyber security threat to government departments after it emerged yesterday that the Department of Health had also been targeted by hackers following the ransomware attack on the HSE on Friday. The Independent reports that the FBI and the UK's National Crime Agency will assist the investigation, while the Mail takes the line that all state departments have been put on high alert with fears that access to pensions and state benefits could be hindered if the Department of Social Protection is targeted. Brit's lead story, The Irish Times, quotes Minister of State for Communications, Oisin Smith, saying that the hackers behind the HSE attack may publish patient data online, although he stressed that much of the information stored centrally by the HSE relates to administrative rather than clinical details. The Irish Sun leads with the line that the Russian criminal gang Wizard Spider is thought to be responsible for both attacks. The Irish Daily Star and Irish Daily Mirror carry quotes in their lead stories from Simon Coveney's interview on RTÉ's This Week programme yesterday, in which he said that the HSE has set up a war room to prevent further cyber attacks. We're at war, and war on hackers are the headlines there. Flights could return by late summer. That's the lead headline in the Irish Examiner, which reports that the government is expected to approve a plan tomorrow to remove most, if not all, European countries from the mandatory hotel quarantine list as part of a move to adopt the EU Digital Green Cert. For its lead story, the Irish News reports that Edwin Poots is expected to delay the appointment of his Stormont ministers to allow time to consult his divided party. While the Belfast Telegraph leads with the newly elected DUP leader's intention to meet with loyalist terror groups. In its lead editorial, The Times suggests that, with an increasing number of younger voters in Northern Ireland open to a new brand of politics, the elevation of Poots could well increase the potential for the growth of a strong middle ground alternative to the DUP and Sinn Féin. It would be ironic, the piece concludes, if the election of a hardline DUP leader helped to undermine the appeal of tribal politics. Writing in The Independent, meanwhile, John Downing asserts that if he sticks with his party unity above all else mantra and fails to take a pragmatic view of the Northern Ireland Protocol, it's hard to see Edwin Poots going anywhere politically. The Examiner has a front page story about how Fianna Fáil isn't expected to add a female candidate to the ticket alongside Taoiseach Micheál Martin in his constituency for the next general election. With gender quotas due to move to 40% from 2023, the paper devotes two inside pages to this story today. And finally, the picture on the front of today's Times is a brother and sister, 10-year-old Ellie and 7-year-old Jack Fields, enjoying ice cream cones in the sunshine in Howth yesterday. In a piece inside today's paper, meanwhile, Connor Pope reports that supply problems and soaring demand have caused a shortage of the mini chocolate flake, which elevates an ice cream cone to a 99. Cadbury's, which makes the crumbly chocolate bars that have been sitting on top of ice cream cones for almost 100 years, confirmed the shortage, but said that they're working hard to boost supplies. Pope also tells us that the 99 got its name in honour of the elite guard of 99 soldiers who traditionally protected Italian monarchs and was used to appeal to expat Italians who dominated the ice cream business in Ireland and Britain.
Efforts are continuing today to restore the HSE's computer systems, which were shut down last Friday following an attack by hackers. In the meantime, however, thousands of patients will have appointments, scans and procedures cancelled. In some cases, they may already have been waiting a considerable length of time. We'll be hearing from patients in a few moments. First, though, for the latest on the investigation into the attack, we can talk to our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds. Paul, several days on, what's known about the nature of this attack?
Well, we've more information now on the background and how it all came about, Rachel. We heard about this first on Morning Ireland last Friday when the HSE was attacked, but actually it was the Department of Health that first noticed suspicious activity on their computer systems the day before, and they contacted the National Cyber Security Agency. Now, its job is to manage cyber security incidents and attacks across government, and this one has turned out to be the most serious ever attack on the state's critical infrastructure. Now, the NCSC activated its crisis response procedures and called in an outside commercial specialist IT incident response company. Investigators found a remote access tool known as a Cobalt Strike Beacon on the system. This is something that hackers use to move within computer networks before launching their virus and then demanding a ransom. The Department of Health acted quickly enough to prevent the cyber criminals from detonating their malware, which is known as Conti, on its systems. The specialists used a combination of programs, tools, antivirus software. They detected an attempt by the criminal gang to launch their ransomware, and they stopped it. The result, they say, is that the systems at the Department of Health have not been as badly damaged and should be up and running soon. The HSE, however, were not so lucky. They first realised that they were under attack in the early hours of Friday morning, and by that time, the criminals had inserted the Conti ransomware and left a digital ransom note. So, I mean, much like a kidnapper inviting someone to drop money off, the note contained a link with an invitation to chat with the criminals on the dark net with a view to paying a ransom to get the data back.
So how much do the authorities know now about the gang believed to be behind this?
Yeah, there's a lot known about this gang. I mean, the National Cyber Security Centre believes the organised cybercrime group behind the two attacks is a highly technically proficient gang of criminals that are known as Wizard Spider. Now, they're based in Eastern Europe. The gang is not apparently interested in terrorism or espionage, only money. And it's been responsible for several cyber attacks all over the world. Wizard Spider has been carrying out ransomware attacks against a variety of organisations, state bodies, commercial corporations, healthcare facilities and hospitals in other countries since at least 2018. Investigators believe they've made millions from ransom demands and are a target of the FBI, the UK's National Crime Agency, Interpol, Europol and now the Garda's National Cybercrime Bureau. There was a document published online over the weekend claiming to show that the gang in this case wanted $20 million. Now, that has been dismissed by those here who are dealing with Wizard Spider. They say the gang is looking for millions to enable the HSE and the Department of Health to retrieve the data that has been lost. Not that figure, but the government insists Ireland will not pay. But, however, the damage that's already been done will cost millions to repair.
How long is it likely to be before the systems are fully operational again? Or is it possible to say at this stage?
I don't even know. They're saying, you know, weeks, possibly months for the HSE. The Department of Health should be quicker, is what they're saying, to restore their systems. I see the minister is quoted this morning as saying that there are backup systems, which if that is true and if that is the case, if they've discovered that, that the data has been backed up, it certainly will mitigate the damage that has already been done. I mean, both the HSE and the Department of Health are responsible for rebuilding their own systems. The National Cybersecurity Agency is providing support and assistance both in responding, but is also more focused now on potential further attacks to other networks. And it has issued advice and warnings to other government departments, statutory and voluntary organisations and commercial companies. Now, we're told so far there's no evidence that any other government department or body has been affected by this attack. The NCSASC is analysing the nature of the attack. It has gathered information not only about who was responsible, but what are the tools, what techniques they used, what are the factors to look out for in case of future attacks. I mean, it does know, it believes it knows, how long the cyber criminals have been in the computer systems because it has found their digital footprints. But it still doesn't know how they got in. Was it through a backdoor security weakness? Did someone click on a link and let them in? The Garda Cybercrime Bureau is in charge of the criminal investigation, so it's liaising with Europol and Interpol. And while they may identify the individuals within the gang responsible, they're most likely to be in countries beyond the reach of this jurisdiction. So gang members may be put on, say, no-fly zones, international watch lists. They may be the target of international law enforcement. They may be confined to their own countries, but it's unlikely to deter them. And realistically, it's unlikely that any of them will be brought to justice here.
Paul, thank you. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
More now on the effects of the cyber attack. We'll hear shortly from Children's Hospitals and later from the HSC. But first, our reporter, Amy Nereida, has been hearing from some of the people who've had their appointments cancelled, starting with Emer Craig.
I'm a 38-year-old from Walkinstown. I have advanced breast cancer, so it has spread beyond the breast, which is treatable but not curable. So you have to be regularly monitored, and they just said we'll get it treated straight away, and that had started last week. And of course it's radiation, so they have to have the computer system, you know, because everything has to be so precise when they're doing radiation without doing damage. It got cancelled on Friday, and I'm not sure what the story is now for this week going forward, but it has really thrown me. I will become stressed if this goes on into Tuesday, Wednesday, because you'd be afraid that the cancer would progress and it will be irreversible. Because you have no control over your cancer, you need to have, for your mental health, some sort of control of your life to keep going.
My name's Natasha White and I'm from Ballyferma in Dublin. And my son is Andre Gleason. He's 14 and a half and he was diagnosed with Down's arthropathy about 5 years ago now, I think it was. And ever since then, we've been kind of chopping and changing between different medications. And as of yet, we haven't found a medication. Tomorrow, on Monday, he was due to be seen by the rheumatology to have his medication changed again, because his mobility is actually after getting so bad lately because the medication isn't working. And I was devastated, to be honest. Like, I actually wanted to cry because I was so happy when I received the appointment. I only got this appointment last week. When he's not on the medication that's working, he's in constant pain. He now gets up in the mornings, he's unable to get himself ready for school. And then at the end of every day, he's literally in tears because he's in so much pain. So I have to watch him go through that every single day.
I'm Marie Davey. I'm actually in the Mater Hospital in Dublin at the moment. I had major cancer surgery over 2 weeks ago. I have a really rare form of appendix cancer. I just need some further tests, including an MRI, which I was actually due to have on Friday. But then the cyber attack took place and it's just put everything on hold. So it will delay my discharge. I had been hoping to be discharged this weekend because my healing from a surgery is going well. I did manage to avail of a brain scan yesterday. That had been delayed by a day. It's disgusting, really disgusting what these cyber criminals are doing.
I'm Ashley McNiff and my son is Jack and he's a 15-year-old boy. He has severe to profound intellectual disability. He uses a wheelchair. He has a rare disease and he has Down syndrome. He has chronic arthritis and he suffers from a lot of pain. One of his main medical teams would be rheumatology. And tomorrow, Monday, he had an urgent appointment, which was brought forward from next month to discuss changing a biologic drug to a different type of drug. He was in hospital for 3 weeks due to pain. We were really looking forward to this appointment. So yeah, it's really disappointing. And it's just so malicious of these criminals that they would target people who are vulnerable and who are sick.
Ashley McNiff talking with our reporter Amy Ní Riada. Dr. Kira Martin is Clinical Director of Children's Health Ireland. That's the Children's Hospitals at Talla, Crumlin, Temple Street in Dublin, and the Paediatric Outpatients at Urgent Care Centre at Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown, where all elective inpatient operations, day cases and outpatient clinics today and tomorrow have been cancelled. Dr. Martin, good morning. Thanks for speaking to us today.
No problem.
I know you've been very busy over the last few days, calling lots of families to tell them that their children's operations have been cancelled.
Indeed, we've had a lot of phone calls were made over the weekend. I want to just let people know that any urgent day case or elective admissions are going ahead. So we were busy going through all of our files over the weekend to establish what we can do for the next 2 days. So we thought the best thing to do was to cancel our non-elective and or to cancel our outpatients and some of our elective admissions. So that will just give us a little space to understand what we need to do for the rest of the week. But anyone who's urgent, we've been able to bring in.
Can you give me examples of the kind of children's operations that won't happen today?
I would say if you're waiting for something that we might call a more routine operation, so something that can wait a week or two, for something like that, we will delay you for the week or two. So if you were coming in to have, say, an examination, a scope perhaps on a joint or a look down into the bowel, something like that, we will defer that probably for the next week or two. So what we've had a look to see if there's anything that needs to be done this week, we will absolutely do it. But if it can wait a week, we will give ourselves a little space because, as you've heard from your other callers and the people on, we don't have access to people's x-rays. We don't have access to people's previous blood tests. So whatever we do, we have to be very sure it's safe to do. And over the next couple of days, we'll be putting in new processes around that. So it'll give us a little time to get that ready.
How have people taken the news when you've been making those phone calls?
Oh, I think you heard from your callers before. People are very disappointed. You know, for us, we know we have, you know, up to 112 children and families coming in for day cases every day. But for each one of those families, it's a day that they've had marked in their diary for a long time. They've had a lot of preparation about it. They've prepared their child to come into hospital, which isn't easy. And it's a big deal, we know that, to say, actually, we've had to cancel you today. But we promise we will bring people back in. We will get them a day as soon as we can.
And will these cancellations, Dr. Martin, include cases where children were already waiting because of COVID?
Yes, COVID has made a difference to us over the last year. We've had to reduce the number of children we have in on any one day. So we've already been working on a curtailed or a shortened day case list. And really only over the last week or two, we felt we were getting ready to go back to normal increased numbers again. But obviously this week now we have to just again come back, look at our lists
and really just focus on the very urgent cases this week.
Have you managed to get in touch with everyone affected? Will people know if their appointment has been postponed?
That's tricky, because for something like outpatients, we haven't access to everybody's phone numbers. So, you know, we would have up to 900 or up to 600 children a day coming into our outpatients. So what we've done is we said, look, watch the websites. If you're due to come to Tala or to Crumlin or to Temple Street or to Connolly, have a look at the website and we'll have specific information there for you. For example, our fracture clinics, trauma clinics, they're running as normal today. So we'll meet today and we'll decide what happens tomorrow. We'll meet tomorrow and we'll work out Wednesday. So we're asking people to keep an eye on the website.
Emergency departments are open too, but are people going to have to wait longer, particularly if they're looking for x-rays?
What we're doing in the emergency departments and our urgent care centre is we're seeing all children as normal, and we would see up to 400 a day across Dublin. But what we do with x-rays is once we request an x-ray, we walk the patient over to x-ray. The x-ray will be taken and then the doctor has a look at the x-ray on the screen in the x-ray room. So it does delay things because no other x-ray can happen at that time. And it'll make things a little slower. We will absolutely see everybody. We're asking people just to really come only if you feel you need to come with an emergency for the next day or two until we get our processes in place. But we will be able to see people.
How long are you expecting all this to last?
Well, I honestly don't know. I think this happened Friday, so for us, from a clinical kind of patient-facing point of view, it's day-to-day. We're relying on our ICT teams and all the amazing work they've been doing, not only to sort out the problem and get the systems back up in place, but they're also working with us to put workaround systems in place that are safe. So I don't honestly know. We're doing it day by day for the moment. We certainly know this week is affected, and I think as the days go on, we'll know a little bit more what the next few weeks will look like.
Dr. Martin, you've had a very long year already, and now this. How are you all in the children's hospitals?
I think there's a resilience in the children's hospital with our staff. You know, it has been a long year. I think we felt we might have been coming to the end of it, but we, you know, with more of our vulnerable patients vaccinated, with our staff vaccinated, we felt, gosh, this is the time now we can come back to normal, see all the patients, you know, as we normally would. And this has been tricky. I think with all crisis, people just work for the patient's benefit. So certainly for the first few weeks or for the first few days, nobody thinks about themselves. And it's really, how do we work to get this done? So I think we'll see as the year goes on. But for the moment, we have an incredible team of resilient healthcare workers who are working for children.
Thank you very much for taking our call. Yes, Ciara, sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, just for parents who may be worried, you know, most of our children attending, say, for rheumatology, cystic fibrosis, oncology, cancer, we know the patients. So if they ring up the nurses, the dietitians, the physiotherapists, the doctors, they know their patients, so don't worry.
Okay. Dr. Ciara Martin, thank you for that. She's Clinical Director of Children's Health Ireland.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with IKEA Dealers of Ireland. Our doors are open again for sales and test drives. Find your local Kia dealer at kia.com.
So good, Darren Frehel, to hear coverage from football and hurling games over the weekend. A welcome return to some normality in a summer, which might just see the Olympic Games too.
Well, Gavin, that is where we are going to start this morning, because we got some great news on the Irish rowing team yesterday. Two more crews have qualified for the Games. The women's four of Afric Kyo, Emer Lam, Fiona Murta and Emily Hegarty. They won the final of their event in Lucerne. And then young Aoife Casey and Margaret Cremin got the job done in the lightweight double. Ireland now have an unprecedented six boats heading for Tokyo. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by one of those heroes on the line from Lucerne right now. Afric Kyo, good morning and congratulations. What does this mean to you right now?
Hi Darren, how are you? God, yeah, it just means the world, really, to be honest. We've waited so long for the opportunity to race again, to qualify, and for it to all go to plan and to finally get those extra seats booked. It's just such a massive relief, really.
Now, can you talk to me about the atmosphere within the group? There's a special bond. I got to see it firsthand before COVID. I got to spend a bit of time with you guys. How important has that atmosphere and that unity in your group to get you on that plane to Tokyo?
Yeah, I think that really has been the driving force for us all, to be honest. You know, at the start of the Olympiad, I think the more realistic goal for us was to probably maybe qualify one heavyweight women's boat outside of Sunita, of course. And I think as time went on and we just, you know, the competitive group started to build and build, we started to think, okay, well, you know, maybe we should aim for two. And I think for both seat boats to qualify is just, it's just a dream, really.
I think you might need your own charter flight. How many is that all together going now?
I think overall it's 13 athletes.
It's incredible because Sunita was there in London. She was the sole competitor in 2012 and now six crews. What's the secret behind that rise?
Well, I think it's just a lot of hard work. And I think, you know, for me, seeing Sunita in London, you know, that was amazing, but it was kind of out of reach for me. You know, I wasn't down there training at the time. And then as Rio came and I kind of started to see people that I grew up with, you know, Gary and Paul, Claire, like they started to achieve, you know, Olympic success. And that's, I think, when our generation started to realize, you know, it is achievable for us too.
How long have you been rowing? When did you take up the sport?
I started in the Jez. I think I started in the Jez in Galway in 2004. So yeah, it's been a long, long road at this stage.
But you've fulfilled your life ambition. Can I finish up by asking you, what will your ambitions be in Tokyo? How far can you guys go as a team?
Well, I think at this stage, you know, we're looking at medals. Like, we just want to keep building on our success. And, you know, we were delighted with our performance at Europeans, and we were so close to crews who have been medaling on the world stage as well. So I think, you know, why not just give it this one last big push before the Games?
Well done, Afric. We're all extremely proud of you. I know you're still there in Lucerne with the team, but we're looking forward to having you home and wishing you the very best for the summer ahead. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much.
Now, such a busy weekend in the Allianz Leagues. I went through all the details of the action earlier in the show, comprehensive reports on the RT Sport website and the news app as well. But lots to talk about again in terms of rule changes, and I think that has dominated much of the talk. Of course, the advantage rule and cynical fouling to the fore again. RT analyst Oisín McConville joins me now. First weekend to look at the football closely, Oisín. How did you feel about that that cynical rule for fouling?
I think, it came to play in certain games. Obviously, the big one was, you know, the Dublin-Roscommon game, where we had a couple of penalties that I suppose you could question. I think once we leave it down to the discretion of the referee, we're going to create issues for ourselves. I think the advantage rule is a significant one, because this advantage rule was something which I felt had actually worked quite well, and I don't understand really why we tinkered with it. But look, it's early stages. I do understand that we have to address the cynical end of things, but I do think that also that, you know, we are encouraging sort of a bit of gamesmanship, if you like. And I think we've seen a little bit of that at the weekend. So that's hopefully something that we can eradicate pretty quickly, and that referees can stamp down on and realise what the difference is between somebody who throws themselves to the ground and is genuinely being tackled in a defensive way. So I think it's suck it and see for a while, but I think on evidence of what we've seen so far, I'll be a little bit concerned about it.
Yeah, okay. So much action over the week. Was there any standout moments for you?
Yeah, I think for a lot of teams, Darren, the league is where it's at. And if you go down to divisions, I think significant wins for Sligo, Antrim, who are all looking out of that Division 4. I think Derry result obviously stands out big time. You know, 21 points to 5. I mean, that's a significant win for them. And I think as Clare as well. And I think as if you come up the divisions, then the standout performance of the weekend from an attacking point of view and just total football was Kerry. and obviously, you know, if you want to counteract that with, you know, a performance, that a forgettable performance, your own Galway on Saturday will be hoping for this weekend to come pretty quickly so they can eradicate and forget about what happened last weekend.
Yeah, and a quick word on Armagh. You must have been happy to see them back at Division 1, Oisín.
Yeah, I didn't want to mention them because I think we have two tough games coming up, but that was a significant game for Armagh, and I think, you know, both teams realised that yesterday, and it was played at a pretty ferocious pace, and it was a brilliant way for Armagh to get off the mark.
Oisín, great talking to you as always. A sure sign that the summer's coming. We've Oisín McConville back on a Monday morning here on the show. Liverpool kept their bid for a top four in the Premier League on track. 2-1 win against West Brom. We heard from the man of the moment, Alisson, a little bit earlier on in the show. A late header winner. What a goal that was. Wins also for Tottenham, who beat Wolves, Crystal Palace and Sheffield United as well. Barcelona won the Women's Champions League. This game was pretty much over after about 18, 20 minutes. They won 4-0. All four goals coming in the first half against Chelsea. Another great finish for Dan Martin, who was fifth on stage 9 of the Giro. Win went to Egan Bernal, who now leads overall. But Dan right in there in the top 10. And finally, I'm afraid Seamus Power's effort really just came up a little bit short of the Byron Nelson, in contention for long periods of that final round, but just faded at the end. Keong Hun Lee won the Byron Nelson on the PGA Tour, but Seamus in the top 10 after a great performance over the weekend. That's your sport for now.
We're returning next to the hacking attack which has crippled the HSE's computer system. Joining us now is the Chief Executive of the HSE, Paul Reid. Good morning.
Good morning, Nigel.
Can we talk first of all about the impact on patients today and indeed over the coming days? How widespread is this likely to be?
Yeah, well, I think as you've already heard this morning, in terms of maternity services and also in terms of children's services, but equally in adult services across the board, it's extremely serious for us. I mean, and indeed the risks increase every day as we progress. This is quite a very serious criminal act. On sick people, and it's having very severe consequences for us. We are setting out to mitigate, obviously, as much as we can, the extent possible, some of those impacts. So the approach that we've been taking over the weekend has been, our teams have been working around the clock throughout the weekend with the best national and international expertise on technology and cybercrime. We've set out three priorities, Rachel, very briefly, just to mitigate all of this. And first of all, is we do see an opportunity to bring on the voluntary hospitals, about 19 voluntary hospitals who would have a lot of standalone systems themselves but need connectivity to some of the HSE systems. So we're focusing on those, maybe the bigger Dublin ones and ones in Cork, so the likes of the Mater James's, Beaumont, St Vincent's, Talla and Mercy in Cork and South Infirmary. So bigger hospitals we see an opportunity to bring on sooner. We're working with those throughout the weekend. Toolkits have been deployed to see, to work on that throughout today and tomorrow, try get those up first. In parallel then, aiming to try work to get a lot of our diagnostic systems up, our lab systems, patient access systems, and particularly oncology systems will be priority. And then thirdly is trying to get the basic connectivity, to which we rely on hugely in terms of transferring information. It's the basic mail servers, sharing access of information, Microsoft tools, supports, etc. So three parallel streams, but quite serious impacts.
As you say yourself there, we know that many diagnostic services are affected and we know that scans in particular are affected. If somebody is in urgent need of a scan or a particular test, will they be looked after?
Yeah, well, across the board, even when we do get the voluntaries back up, they will indeed be relying on our radiation and diagnostic systems, and particularly what's called NIMIS, or National Imaging System. And that's one, as I say, we're working on in parallel, particularly as it happens today and experience while those systems are down. There are certain urgent care, so for example, cancer or urgent radiology, that we're putting in alternative processes for, some support through the private hospitals. So consultants will be talking with some patients, for example, like
right.
that.
So just to be clear about that, private hospitals are going to be used over the next few days at least?
Yeah, we've been working with the private hospitals. We have, as you know, through COVID, been using some of the private hospitals for some support, and particularly in terms of this, and specifically related to oncology, we're putting in some alternative pathways. But again, I would say to all the patients, everybody look at our hse.ie site. It has been, I know you've covered it there this morning, it's been updated regularly every hour with information on every service in every site all across the country.
How long is this disruption likely to last?
Well, that's the unknown, Rachel, unfortunately, for right now. This is a really very serious hit, a complex hit to stand back each of the systems. What I can say is we have established over the weekend what we call a kind of foundation layer, a basic foundation layer, which we can start to build each of the systems. We're working through over the weekend those priority systems I just outlined to you on a national basis. First of all, we're working through them to see to what extent some of them are being compromised. So for the likes of our patient administration system that a lot of our hospitals in particular would rely on, we're seeing that some hospitals may, information may have been compromised, others weren't. So we're trying to prioritise, get those up as quick as we can, the ones that weren't. We'll work through today and tomorrow to try bring as much of those up as we can. But this will impact us well throughout this week. And even as we get those systems up, there's a period of time of which it's impossible to say what will stay stable, the interconnectivity between each of those systems. So we are in for a period well beyond this week of really monitoring, assessing the impacts of this.
Listening to what you're saying there, you can confirm then that the hackers have accessed patient information?
Yeah, well, what we know is, well, first of all, we know that that's what they set out to do. They set out to access information, hold organisations to ransom, and hold that information until, you know, an engagement or ransom is paid. That's what they set out to do. What we know as we go work through it, we can't say, you know, what has been, at this stage, not in a position to say what has been extracted or taken from our systems. But we do know certain levels of information are compromised. Obviously, we would engage with the Data Protection Commissioner, etc., on those kind of issues, but not fully established yet to what extent, because what we have to do, Rachel, is it's not just those core systems I outlined to you. We then have to go into each of the other over 2,000 systems that we would have and assess what levels of access may have been gained through each of those systems too. So this is a much longer game in terms of fully understanding the impacts.
And have they accessed information about staff? I'm thinking about payroll and the like.
Well, again, equally, we're working parallel all this weekend to bring back our core, corporate services, particularly payroll as well. And we are, you know, again, assessing each of those because, again, we are dealing with some legacy systems here that you'd be familiar with from the old Eastern Health Boards. So some of them in a central system, some not. So, again, each of those has to be gone through individually. But no information just yet, no knowledge just yet that that has been compromised.
But there is a danger that personal details may be dumped somewhere online.
Oh, look, the reality of all of this, Rachel, and again, we can't fudge it. The reality of this, that's what these organisations set out to do. We haven't established that that is what level of detail they fully have, but that's what they set out to do. And everything we're doing since we became aware of this on Friday night is setting out to mitigate that, to rebuild our services, to reassess what we have and has not been accessed, what may have been accessed, and how we can take it back securely. But it's a really difficult process we're in.
What can you tell us?
We are making progress, I should say, through the weekend, but, you know, it's going to be slow.
What can you tell us then about the ransom demand? How much are they looking for?
I can't, Rachel, because to be really straight with you, what happens in these situations, and we would go firmly by national security guidelines, what happens in these situations is notifications are left on servers, and it sets out a process to start engaging with these organisations. Once those notifications are left, we would immediately engage with national cyber security teams, and they would take over the process from them. So we do have this now in hands of the intelligence agencies of the state and supported by the Garda Criminal Cyber Bureau as well. So that's really a process that goes into that.
But just to be clear, do you know how much is being sought?
Personally, Rachel, I don't. That's to be straight with you. We put that straight into the hands of the national security teams, and that's the process that goes into. We are primarily focused in the HSE on the restoring the national systems and restoring and mitigating the impacts on our services and protecting the data. They're the three strands that we're focused on.
And is repairing the damage to the system, is it likely to cost a significant amount of money?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, what we have to do here is very significant rebuild, not just in terms of resources, very significant investment to support the security of the information as we are rebuilding it. what we have identified is to set out the mitigation of the impact that has been put onto the system, I guess, in terms of the malware and how we address that and mitigate that impact. So there's very significant investments in time, resources, people, systems that we'd have to put into the full extent. We won't know for some time, but this is, you know, this is a very significant. We do invest significantly in ITA every year, but this will be certainly.
But you're probably talking about millions to fix this, are you?
Oh, absolutely. This will be in tens of millions in terms of impacts on our systems. There's no doubt about it. But again, we'll assess the full impact of that as we work through. But, you know, I think from our perspective right now, indeed, and now from the government's perspective, the investment, whatever investment is required, is certainly here, and we're doing it and we're carrying on. And that's not a factor. It's really just protecting the service, protecting our patients to the greatest extent we can, and getting the services going.
And on the other matter that has occupied you for the past 14, 15 months, the COVID situation, we know that there have been changes to the process for anybody seeking a COVID test. What's the situation this morning?
Yeah, well, what I can say positively on that, we did immediately mitigate the impacts in terms of our testing and tracing system all across the country. So that has been continuing throughout with workarounds, because we don't have the automated referral process from a GP to a test system. But people, if they do feel they have symptoms, I'd still say just contact your GP, because they may have other symptoms than COVID. But there is a pathway now for people can go to all of our test system or all of our test centres all across the country if they're symptomatic and get a test.
And they can go there without a referral.
And they can go there without a referral if symptomatic. And it's not just a walk-in centres, it's all of our sites. So just look at our site, look at all the details of the times and locations. And very positively, what I can say, if you see the numbers of tests that we've done over the weekend, they are in line with what we would normally do on a weekend, and equally the cases that we have issued out over the weekend, somewhere between 300 and 400 each day, is on average in line with what we have been at. Okay. So we're not seeing the impacts on that. So thankfully, we're protecting.
And just finally then, on the vaccination programme, does it remain unaffected?
Yeah, very positively, just to say, I mean, if I just look at the data from this morning, over 2.1 million doses administered now in total, well over 1.5 million, over 41% of the population now having had a dose one, over 560,000 had a dose two, so 15% of the population. If you look at this week's alone, we will have done well over 250,000. I don't have the data in from the GPs and clinics because of the impact in some of the system, but likely somewhere between 260,000, 270,000 will have been completed by the end of yesterday evening. So really strong progress on all the right. vaccination programme. So to reassure your listeners in terms of COVID-related issues, testing and tracing continuing and vaccinations continuing, but ultimately our priority right now is to work on the impacts on their services.
All right, Paul Reid, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
Our Europe editor Tony Connolly is reporting this morning that the government here is concerned at the increasingly hostile tone of the UK government towards the protocol. Why are they concerned, Tony?
Well, Gavin, this emerged last week. First of all, David Frost, the UK's chief Brexit minister, was in Northern Ireland meeting stakeholders, including members of the Loyalist Communities Council. And he said afterwards that the protocol may not be sustainable. And then during the meeting between the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin and Boris Johnson in Chequers, again, a hardening of the narrative from the UK on the protocol. And over the weekend, David Frost writing in the Mail on Sunday that the protocol was not sustainable. Some briefing from the UK side to UK newspapers that certainly in the Daily Telegraph that the protocol was dead in the water, that the EU had to come up with solutions by July the 12th, we don't know the outcome if there is no solution by then, but certainly this amounts to a stronger sense of hostility from the UK side to the Northern Ireland Protocol, which of course the UK jointly negotiated. And the fear in the government is either this is a negotiating tactic for the UK to get more concessions, or it is raising expectations among unionists that the protocol could be somehow ditched or amended radically, and the government feels that that is simply a dangerous path to go down, especially now given the election of Edwin Poots as DUP leader, who would be seen as more hard line on the protocol.
Tony, thank you. That's our Europe editor, Tony Connolly.